From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The Soviet Union is entering a winter of trouble. Stores have little food on the shelves. There's even talk of famine. Republics want to break from the Union, and Gorbachev has lost the trust of the people. On today's Fresh Air, journalist Hedrick Smith on the latest upheavals in the post-Cold War Soviet Union. Also, some kitchen science from Harold McGee, who has the answer to such questions as, why do beans give you gas? Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by two female rappers. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Edward Scissorhands, about a boy with scissors for hands, directed by Tim Burton of Batman and Beetlejuice fame. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Saddam Hussein has announced all hostages in Iraq and Kuwait are free to leave those countries, but some Arab diplomats worry that Iraq's gesture has more to do with its military preparedness than its desire for peace. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
It should be unqualified good news, and good news it is that more than 2,000 Western and Japanese hostages, along with several thousand Russians, will soon be leaving Iraq and Kuwait. There's no question, say diplomats in neighboring Jordan, that Iraq wants to clear the table so that dialogue can begin in earnest. The hostages were becoming an issue in themselves. But some Arab diplomats close to talks in Baghdad with President Saddam Hussein last Tuesday say he just doesn't need the hostages any longer. Iraq has bought itself some time, they say. It's beefed up its defenses in southern Iraq and Kuwait and dug underground bomb shelters it believes capable of withstanding an American first strike. That doesn't mean Iraq wants war, they say, but today Iraq announced that it had moved another 30,000 troops to southern Iraq and Kuwait. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
The Pentagon said today that in addition to the 30,000 additional troops, Iraq has moved 200 more tanks into Kuwait and nearby parts of Iraq. Defense Department spokesman Bob Hall said that Iraq now has 480,000 soldiers deployed in the region. He said that most of the additional troops have been moved from areas on the border with Iran. The spokesman also said that Iraq has moved more troops into positions west of the Kuwaiti border. He said that tactic appears to be designed to prevent the multinational forces from trying to go around the Iraqi defenses in Kuwait. The Congressional Budget Office reported today that the Persian Gulf crisis and the slowing economy will make it difficult to tackle the federal budget deficit. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Budget Office told members of Congress today that the federal deficit will rise from $200 billion this year to $250 billion next year before slowly beginning to decline. Robert Reischauer, director of the office, said today the short-term budget forecast has grown considerably worse since Iraq's August 2nd invasion of Kuwait, but the long-term outlook, he says, has improved. By fiscal 1995, he predicts the federal deficit will fall below $100 billion for the first time in 14 years. That news was overshadowed by the economic unknowns associated with U.S. involvement in the Persian Gulf. Members of Congress are growing concerned about how to pay for the American military presence. Some have suggested an income tax surcharge, similar to the surtax levied to pay for the Vietnam War. Others say a protracted war in the Gulf will lead to drastic cuts in domestic programs. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 8 points today to close at 2,602.47. Advances led declines by about 4-3. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Hedrick Smith first covered the Soviet Union when it was considered America's most feared enemy. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from Moscow for the New York Times, where he was the bureau chief from 1971 to 1974. And his book, The Russians, was an international bestseller. 2 years ago, Smith began returning to the Soviet Union to see the new society shaped by Mikhail Gorbachev's policies of glasnost and perestroika. He has a new book about the revolutionary changes called The New Russians. Earlier this year, Smith hosted a four-part series for PBS called Inside Gorbachev's USSR. A year ago, it seemed that peace was breaking out around the world with the victories of pro-democracy movements throughout Eastern Europe. But recent events in the Gulf have created unexpected pressures for Gorbachev's new foreign policy.
It obviously has been a difficult situation for Gorbachev and the new Russian leadership in Moscow. because what they really want is a peaceful world. Perestroika is all based on a long-term strategy of getting along with the rest of the world and not having problems, particularly with the West, because they need Western credits and Western technology and basically a quiet situation in the world so they can devote themselves to their internal affairs. So Saddam Hussein has not only thrown a curve at us, but he's thrown a curve at Gorbachev, and Gorbachev has obviously had a lot of difficulty dealing with it. The decision to go with the West, to go with George Bush on the United Nations sanctions at first was one that they made very quickly. It fitted in with Gorbachev's new thinking. Obviously, Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, the foreign minister, have been more resistant to the idea of using force. But even on that now, they've come around, which is an indication of how much the new thinking has taken hold in Soviet foreign policy and how the pressing needs of modernizing that economy override the traditional politics of the Cold War, even in the Third World.
Iraq had been an ally of the Soviet Union. What was the basis of that relationship?
Well, fundamentally, it was a way of challenging the West. The Russian leadership, going back to the Tsars as well as the Communists, has always been inclined to push to the south towards the warm water ports, the landmass of Russia being so northerly and landlocked and cold. The outlet through Leningrad, through the Baltic Sea, is sometimes difficult in the wintertime. There's a tendency to push towards the south, towards oil. And Iraq was a great, huge country, which brought them very close to the Persian Gulf. That is, the Russians put them on the Persian Gulf, as it were. So they helped build the Iraqi army. They equipped the Iraqi army. They backed the Iraqis. Of course, they've been on the Arab side of the Arab-Israeli dispute. The Russians have for a long time. So all this fit very well with Moscow's global politics.
It's more than the Gulf crisis that's eclipsed last year's victories, last year's sense of peace breaking out around the world. There are immense problems in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe now, problems that have to be faced after the euphoria of the events of a year ago. In the Soviet Union, they're facing a terrible food shortage, although I guess it's unclear whether it's a food shortage or more of a distribution problem.
There's no question it's a huge distribution problem. What we're seeing, Terry, is the breakdown of the Soviet economic system. It was something, I think, that had to happen. I think that a lot of Western observers have sort of looked at the functioning of the Soviet economy, our American economic experts on the Soviet economy, and said, look, it's all breaking down. It's not working. There's going to be a calamity. There's going to be a collapse. It's chaos and so forth. What a terrible thing. Gorbachev's going to get thrown out and so forth. Some of that may happen. But if you were going to move from a highly structured state system run by Gosplan, the state planning agency, in which orders were given to every factory on how much it would produce, where it would get its raw materials, what it would charge for its output, in fact, exactly what it would produce, and you're going to shift away towards a market economy, it seems to me almost inevitable that you are going to go through a period such as the one the Soviets are now going through. It's painful. It is chaotic. It's got some political dangers in it. But economically speaking, it seems to me it was somewhat predictable. And oddly, the very process of reform may be going on while the leaders debate at the top, while Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin, the renegade Moscow party chief, former Moscow party chief, are arguing about market reform. In fact, it may be occurring at the grassroots level. If you can't get the state system to force the and to order the state farms and the collective farms, these huge farms they have all around the country, to harvest their grain and their potatoes and their cabbages and grow their raise their meat and poultry and so forth and ship it into the cities by state orders, then what starts to happen is when the shelves of the state stores in the cities of Moscow and Leningrad and Sverdlovsk and Volgograd and so on are empty, people start adjusting to a new economic system on their own. They start going to buy in the farmers' markets where farmers can grow some of their own goods on their own private vegetable plots next to their homes. Or the city of Moscow, the new reform government in the city of Moscow, which was elected last spring, or in Leningrad or some of these other cities, they begin making their own deals with the state and collective farms, and the stuff gets transferred directly. Russians and other Soviet nationalities have been doing this for decades under the Soviet system illegally. And what's going on now is it's becoming, if not officially sanctioned as national policy, at least tolerated by the authorities because that's the only way, particularly with food, that you can get the stuff there.
Gorbachev declined to pick up his Nobel Peace Prize recently because things were so bad at home. He felt he couldn't take another trip out of the country. And then he went before people and he declared himself guilty before the working class, guilty in part for the food shortages. Do you think Gorbachev is taking the rap when it's a problem that couldn't be avoided? Or do you think that he is responsible for problems that the Soviets are facing now, like the food shortages?
Both. I think that some of this couldn't be avoided. It was going to happen, and whoever's watch it would happen on would be unpopular and would be criticized. Boris Yeltsin, who is a very charismatic, dynamic, populist leader who got 5 million votes in Moscow in the city elections of 89, got another 1 million votes in the city elections of Sverdlovsk in 1990, would be in trouble himself if he were actually in charge, responsible for the policies. But I do think it's also true that Gorbachev has made some very big mistakes. He moved on economic reform late. He did not begin in 1985 and 86 at the very start with liberalizing reforms. He did not take the plunge as Solidarity has taken in Poland. And by the way, let's look at the vote in Poland recently. Mazowiecki, the prime minister, was not exactly popular in that recent election, and one reason is he's taken the rap for what they did. But at least Solidarity decided that at the moment when they came into office, able to blame the communist leadership of Poland for the problems and enjoying the greatest popularity in their own country that they were ever going to get, that was the moment to take the political risk of swallowing the bitter medicine of unemployment and higher prices and the dislocation of moving to a market economy. Gorbachev, on the other hand, at his moment of maximum popularity in 85 and 86, when he could blame Brezhnev and Stalin and his predecessors, did not take the plunge. So that was a major mistake on his part. So now when there's no food in the stores or not enough food, people are angry at him both because he's the incumbent and the reformers are angry at him because he won't bite the bullet.
Gorbachev was just given more authoritarian powers by the Soviet legislature to give him the clout to try to stop the food shortages. Is this a step in the opposite direction of democracy?
Yeah, it is. It's a danger that, in fact, Gorbachev will become an agent of the right wing. Many people worry about whether or not the right wing in the army and the KGB and the Communist Party will throw him out. Gorbachev is moving over to the right now. He is preempting the right. He has himself, in some ways, become much more the right wing. He's at least a man in the center. He's certainly not on the left in the most progressive part, and he's moved to the right. It is a danger that he's going to move in that direction. But part of the problem is that authority is broken down in that system, and nobody can be a new Stalin again. Gorbachev has gotten more formal powers than certainly he had at the beginning and probably than some of his predecessors had. But formal power won't make it in that country. You have to have also moral authority. At the same time he's been getting more power, his popularity has been falling. And he can't get Boris Yeltsin in the Russian Republic or Landsbergis and Prunskina in the Lithuanian Republic or the new leaders in the Ukraine and some of the people in Central Asia to do what he wants, even though he's got the power theoretically to force him to do it, because he's opened the way to a much more disputatious, pluralistic system in which these people are now saying, darn it, we want to run our own affairs. You want to share power with us? We'll share it. If you don't want to share power with us, at a minimum, we won't do what you want us to do. So what you have is a kind of a paralysis of power, a stalemate.
Why do you think, as the country has moved more toward democracy, that Gorbachev has moved more toward the right?
Well, I think for two reasons, or three reasons. Number one, the situation is chaotic. And for a system which was based on order, and for a people who are used to order for centuries, not just the last 70 years of communism, but going back to Ivan the Terrible, in the 14th and 15th century, before America was ever discovered, for people like that to see the kind of disintegration of the economy and the disintegration of the nation and the retreat from Afghanistan and the retreat from Eastern Europe and to see Armenians in a bloody war against Azerbaijanis and having to send 25,000 Soviet troops into that area, that's scary. They're worried that's going to happen in their city or their province. And so there's a tendency of Russians in that kind of situation to say, hey, we need a krepki kulak. We need a strong hand. We need a new Stalin. So that's number one. That's a kind of a basic instinct of the people to which Gorbachev is responding. And also, crime is on the rise. There are a lot of other problems that are going on. So a tough hand, a kind of a law and order sentiment. Secondly, Gorbachev is a man now who's 59 years old. He's been a reformer because he grew up at the critical time in his youth under Khrushchev. And Khrushchev was a reformer. Gorbachev was in university at that time. He was impressionable. That was a very formative period of his life, not only his life, but that of his generation. And so they caught the bug of reform, which they then began to implement in the middle 80s. But they're also that generation, people now roughly 60 years old. They're also people of the old system. And so they have a hard time going too far. Gorbachev may have reached his limits, and he's constantly being pushed by radicals, by younger people, by more radical people like Boris Yeltsin, to go further. And there's part of his own psyche that is torn between the need for reform, the desire to make things better, and we got to save what we got. We've gone too far. Then thirdly, there is what you were talking about before. There is a right wing. The whole army is not right wing. It's as divided as the rest of the society. But there is a right wing in the party. There's a right wing in the army. There's a right wing in the Interior Ministry, in the KGB, the security services, if you will, which are also pushing him in the opposite direction as the radical reformers. And they're saying, hey, Misha, you've gone too far. You've ruined everything. You got to get tough. So he's feeling political pressures, not only from the man in the street, but he's feeling political pressures within the system. So what do you see? You see Gorbachev zigzagging. He goes for a while on reform, and he zigzags back, and he goes back to the right wing.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is journalist Hedrick Smith, and he reported from the Soviet Union for the New York Times from 1971 to 74, and then 14 years ago, he wrote the best-selling book, The Russians. He returned to the Soviet Union, making many trips between 1988 and 1990, watching the changes under Gorbachev, and he's written a new book called The New Russians. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Hedrick Smith is my guest, author of the new book, The New Russians. You've coined a new phrase to help describe some of what's going on in the Soviet Union now, and I'm thinking of the culture of envy.
You know, we tend to look at politics in any system as a battle of people in the leadership, the arguments that people have over what should be the right policy, the right ideology. In the case of perestroika and reform in the Soviet Union, we look at it in terms of Gorbachev's battle with the hardliners in the party, the bureaucracy, 18 million strong, he says, that wants to hang on to its seats of power. But what we often don't do, I think, Terry, is understand the culture and the mindset of very ordinary people, which is often the most difficult thing to change. Perestroika, I think I said a few minutes ago, is not just a matter of new institutions, beginning elections in a country which hasn't had real elections for 70 years, freeing up the press, moving towards a market economy. It is about changing this mindset of people. And when I talk about the culture of envy, what I'm talking about is something that I've encountered among the Russians as I've traveled around that country, 40,000 miles in the last couple of years on 9 different trips. And also, I've heard about from Russian reformers who are frustrated by not being able to do more. And what they'll say is, our people are jealous, our ordinary people are jealous of other people getting ahead. Being a winner is a good thing in America, and being a loser is not so good. But being a winner in the Soviet Union is not always very popular with a lot of people. I've been on farms, state farms, where I've heard about cases where farmers tried to expand their private plot, and to grow more food and to try to sell it in the market, that while they tried to raise more livestock and expand their small herd of sheep or cattle, and other farmers have let the livestock at night, they've snuck in and they've let the livestock out of the barn, or they burned the barn, or they've destroyed the crops of these people. There's a jealousy and an envy even on the farm. You also run into it in the cities where you've got now about 5 million private entrepreneurs or people in the private sector working, running mom-and-pop grocery stores or restaurants or cleaners or watch repair shops, and some people even running textile factories and brick factories and building roads and that kind of stuff. You find in the cities that workers and other people will smash the windows of these restaurants, or will write dirty slogans all over them, or destroy some of the plants that people are setting up. And the new entrepreneurs have to pay protection money. Part of that is a distaste for capitalism. Part of it is a fear of the market. Part of it is real jealousy at seeing other people get ahead. I had a story told to me, not once, but at least a half a dozen times by different Russians, which illustrates this. And I was asking these different people what it was that made it so difficult to change the motivation of ordinary people. And the mayor of Leningrad, Anatoly Sobchak, told me this story. And as I say, I heard it again in other places. He said, there's a story we have about Ivan, a Russian peasant, in the countryside. And God comes to Ivan one day and says to him, Vanya, you're a good peasant, you work hard in the fields and so forth, but you have a tough life. I'm going to give you one wish. You can wish for anything you want in the world. Vanya is overwhelmed. He's never had this kind of an opportunity before, and he starts dreaming about what he'd like to have. And as he's thinking, he's about to answer God, and God says back to him, according to this story, Vanya, you must remember that whatever it is I give you, I'm going to give twice as much to Volodya, your neighbor, down the road. Well, this drives Ivan crazy. He can't stand the thought of Volodya having that much more than he's going to have. And he doesn't know what to answer to God. And then finally, according to this story, he turns to God and he says, to the sky, I guess, and says to God, God, please take out one of my eyes and take out two of Volodya's eyes. In other words, double my misery to make him worse off. Now, that's a terrible story when you stop to think about it, for anybody to tell about his country and his countrymen. As I say, I heard that again and again. There are other stories that strike the same theme. I won't take long to tell you them. But that is something that is very important. It goes along with the very lax work ethic that a lot of Russians have on factories and in the farms and in the institutes and so forth, that the saying goes among Russian workers, they, meaning the bosses, they pretend to pay us, and we pretend to work. They pretend to pay us, and we pretend to work. In other words, nobody's really pushing it too hard. Russians are capable of working hard. This is not a failing of theirs if they've got a motivation, they got an incentive if they're working for themselves. But they've had decades of communism, and indeed decades before that, even after the end of serfdom under the czars, in which they did everything communally, in which they shared things. And unless there was great motivation and great spirit in their community, there was a tendency to do just enough, but not really to excel. That's an enormous drag on anybody who wants to create reform. To change that mentality, to change that mindset, and to generate a new motivation that people will believe in and work for. That's tough.
Journalist Hedrick Smith is my guest, and he's the author of the best-selling book, The Russians, and a new book called The New Russians that's based on his travels through the Soviet Union between 1988 and 1990. The Soviet military has just been given permission to use force in the republics to defend military installations, monuments, and to defend the military. What's the significance of that?
Well, significance is that the situation has deteriorated so badly that people are pulling down monuments to Lenin, monuments to Soviet patriotism in World War II. You find in the Baltic republics we were talking about just a few minutes ago that people literally would go stand toe-to-toe with the Soviet Red Army and say, get out. We don't want you here. You're occupiers. You came here during World War II, and you're not here by our permission and by our will. We want you to leave. And even in Latvia, one of the city governments, city areas of responsibility around the capital of Riga, literally passed a local council, passed a local ordinance saying that they were going to cut off the food and water and electricity supplies for Soviet army bases in that region of Latvia unless the Soviet troops got out. That's what that was directly in response to, that episode. But what that shows is the degree of tension that has now developed over these nationality issues, over the issues of independence. What's going on, particularly in the Baltics, is that those people are smart enough to realize that they cannot fight the Soviet army. They cannot fight the Russians. There's something like 10 or 11 or 12 million people who live in these Baltic republics. There are 150 million Russians. The Russians have got the artillery, the tanks, the aircraft, the nuclear weapons. So it's not an even fight. So what's going on is that these people in the Baltics are trying to break away, but do it through peaceful protest. In a way, it's similar to Martin Luther King leading the civil rights movement in this country. Nonviolence, civil disobedience, putting the pressure on the central authority without getting into a fight. And then if there's a fight, you throw your hands up and say, fine, throw me in jail. But just understand I'm protesting, and I want the world to notice that this is immoral, illegal, and against my will. And indeed, it's also against the Soviet Constitution, because the Soviet Constitution gives Soviet republics the right to secede. Many people compare the situation improperly between Soviet republics and American states. No American state has it written into the Constitution that it has the right to secede. It is written into the Soviet Constitution, and indeed has been for the last 70 years, that Soviet republics have the right to secede. Now that they want to exercise that right, Gorbachev and the others are throwing up all kinds of obstacles. They want to pass new laws. They want to set new requirements. They want to prevent that from happening. I think in the end they can't resist it, that the will of these people is that strong, and they simply will not collaborate. They won't cooperate with the Soviet leadership unless they got the right to go their own way, settle their own destiny.
Given the food shortages, other economic problems, republics trying to secede, do you still think of what's happened in the Soviet Union as the most extraordinary peaceful revolution of the 20th century?
So far, yes. I mean, if we find that that hundreds of thousands of people die, then obviously that's something I'm going to have to readjust. But at the moment, over the last 5.5, now nearly 6 years since Gorbachev took power, something like 1,000 people have been killed in what you could call political violence. But 1,000 people, terrible as it is, in a society that large, going through as sweeping a change as that one is not really very astonishing. In the same period in the country of Ceylon or in India, several thousand people have died. So ethnic violence is unfortunately a sad fact that exists around the world. The other thing that is important to notice about the violence is that it has taken place basically on the fringes of the Soviet Union, in Central Asia, in the Caucasus, not in the Baltic states, but a bit in Moldavia, in areas a long ways away from the central cities, from Moscow, from Leningrad, from the big Russian cities. Regimes fall and get overthrown in revolutions when there's mass violence in the central cities. They don't get overthrown when there's violence on the periphery. So far, that's an important distinction that Gorbachev and the Russians have been able to maintain. The real test is now going to be, are you going to get food riots and violent suppression in the central Russian cities? If that happens, then my estimate changes, and that will be a great tragedy.
Well, Hedrick Smith, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about the Soviet Union.
It's a great pleasure. It's a fascinating topic, and it's very interesting to talk with you.
Thanks for being here. And Hedrick Smith has a new book about the Soviet Union called The New Russians. Next time, energy analyst Daniel Yergin will talk about the world's oil supply. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Harold McGee's kitchen is his laboratory, where he investigates the science of everyday cooking. He looks into such questions as why does a lemon change the color of tea, and does blowing on hot soup really help? Coming up, the answers to those questions and more. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Down to Earth by Moni Love and Attitude, a hip-hop rhapsody by Shazzy, two albums by two female rappers. And critic Owen Gleiberman reviews the new film by director Tim Burton. It's Edward Scissorhands, starring Johnny Depp, Winona Ryder, Diane Wiest, and Alan Arkin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has directed that all foreigners held in Iraq and Kuwait be allowed to leave. In a letter to Parliament, he argued that his forces in Kuwait and southern Iraq are now strong enough to defend the country against attack, and that foreigners are no longer needed as shields. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The release of all foreigners would be a welcome and significant development if it happened, Secretary of State James Baker said this morning, but he also stressed that it's not enough. Iraq must still pull its troops out of Kuwait and restore the legitimate government there, as the United Nations has demanded. Baker argued that military pressure against Iraq should not be eased just because the hostages may be released.
I think that this is a sign that our strategy of diplomatic and military pressure is working. It seems to me no coincidence that this announcement comes just one week, after the international community has authorized the use of force.
Today, the Pentagon indicated that it's going forward with the buildup of U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Officials in Iraq say that hostages can start leaving this weekend, and those in Baghdad may start applying now for exit papers. However, processing could take days. In New York City, the U.N. ambassador from Iraq said it's hoped that all the hostages will be home in time for Christmas, and it might help if the U.S. sent airplanes to Jordan to pick them up. So far, there's been very little official Arab reaction to Iraq's move to release all foreign hostages. Tim Llewellyn of the BBC says privately there's some relief that there appears to be progress in finding a solution to the Persian Gulf crisis.
For those Arabs, such as the Jordanians and Palestinians, for example, who had to a great extent sympathized with the Iraqi leader, there are two reasons for relief. War, it seems, may be averted if President Saddam Hussein does withdraw from Kuwait, which now seems more likely, and he's established a link between the Kuwaiti and Palestinian issues. If all these positive signals are being read correctly, the Americans are telling President Saddam that, yes, he must leave Kuwait, but, no, he does not have to worry about being hunted down at some later stage by the American and allied military machine. So it seems that a face-saving process is in the making. The Americans and their coalition can argue that by a combination of military threat and diplomatic work at the United Nations, Saddam Hussein will have been ousted from Kuwait. The Iraqis and their Arab friends can look forward to various rewards, a slice of northern Kuwait for the Iraqis, possibly, and a concerted international attempt to sort out the Palestinian question.
Tim Llewellyn of the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 8 points to close at 2,602. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, Owen Gleiberman reviews Tim Burton's new movie, Edward Scissorhands. A lot of rap music is sexist. But not all of it. Rock critic Ken Tucker has been listening to two women rappers. Here's Moni Love with Down to Earth.
I am down to earth, and I'll tell you why. For what it's worth, open up your eyes. Greet the birth of a new sunrise. Anyway, besides conceitment, one of the roots of evil, the treatment. A swift kick up the butt, so how you feel about that? I got this down packed due to the fact I'm down to earth.
Over the past year, the amount of misogyny that has filled rap records has been extensive and depressing. It's not just rap, of course. There's not much difference between the contempt for women shown by a black rapper like Ice-T or a white hard rock act like Warrant, to name two current examples, except for the fact that Ice-T makes much better music, and so his lyrics are that much more dismaying. But in the wake of vicious acts like 2 Live Crew and the Ghetto Boys, and hostile idiots like Big Daddy Kane and Too Short, rap misogyny has become truly oppressive, threatening to characterize rap in the popular imagination. It is heartening and perhaps inevitable, therefore, that a group of women have come along to stand in opposition to this trend. They're female rappers every bit as strong as their male colleagues.
Sitting on a stoop with my mother and my brother and my nephew's mother sneezed. I said, bless you, thank you, she replied. I sighed, my mother said, what's wrong? My brother played a funky song on the box right next to me. But my nephew's expression looked vexed to me. So I tried to cheer him up. I said, what's up, little DCJ? Hey, you should be smiling, it's a sunny day. The family together, out in the good weather. Mom, should I sing a song? She said, whatever's clever, Trevor. So I opened my mouth, began, and I sang. Dwayne, you is a funky little man. Sure enough, I got results. Dwayne cracked a smile. My mom said, Moni, you're the talented child. I'ma go see my friend.
That's Moni Love, a British-born Brooklyn resident in her early 20s. Her debut album, Down to Earth, offers vivid autobiography and a devilish verbal wit. In a recent issue of Interview magazine, Love brightened that jaded publication with enthusiastic talk about the joys of writing raps, of working out metaphors and similes. In her music, women ridicule men who come onto them with the so-called gangster rap attitude. In this context, the song I Do As I Please serves as a kind of manifesto of female assertion. It also happens to be a striking piece of music, using bits of rock guitar as a rhythm for Moni's rap.
Why do fingers insist to point towards me? Is there an observation I don't know about? I can't see clearly exactly what the hang-ups be. And when I break, I'm told there's no need to shout. I have to express exactly what I'm going through. You're stepping on my toes, so I have to let you know. Hypothetically speaking, I have corns. You're squeezing them. Shed some light upon those who dictate direction. I know where I'm at, you get rejection. Injecting opinions of others is as fake as dentures. A whole brand new venture. Skip the lip about tips and break out the fork. Then bring the nagging to a halt. It seems you try to use guilt to bring me to my knees. I'll do exactly as I please. I do as I please.
Another woman doing interesting rap work is Shazzy, whose album title, Attitude, A Hip-Hop Rhapsody, isn't pretentious foolishness. Shazzy is a New York woman whose real name is Sherry Raquel Marsh. She creates intricate rhymes and speaks them forcefully.
Whatever is left for the rest of not to know won't be taught or told and believe it. So Martin Luther King was a great man in his own right. Malcolm X shook up the crowd preaching for black rights. Civil, the leader, leading power for the black man. And anything the man could do, you know the woman can. Taught to believe that a woman was a tool to cook and clean and slave and live in the household's a myth. And you could kiss the butt from the mouth that told you you were raised to believe it. So nine women out of ten will tell you, hell no, I ain't living like a body with no face. Identity is set, my mind is a terrible thing to waste. Chaos, belief of the past, you can believe it. But time is moving too fast, and if you knew what I knew, you'd know to know as of yesterday. Years are adding time, and ignorance is a takeaway.
I believe.
Shazzy's lyrics are often didactic lectures lightened by her musical collaborations with her production partner, DJ Vanguard. If Shazzy has one major flaw, it's that she's pretty humorless. But given all the abuse women have had to take in recent rap music, it's not difficult to imagine why she isn't yucking it up.
Another baby cries in the back, his mama's not there. Daddy's hanging out smoking crack, but what does he care? Kelly's in the bed, her fourth time in labor. Two kids in a home, and the third they couldn't save her. The family's poor, and living on welfare. Will it ever seem to me like anyone does care? If they don't give a damn, nobody else will. Life will go on, and they'll be living like that still. But who am I to say what the level of life should be? It's just my opinion.
There are other interesting women working in rap these days, including MC Lyte, Harmony, and Queen Latifah. They're all reclaiming rap from the men who are attacking them, which in turn is forcing rap's audience to consider all the various messages and implications in this music, which is what I think continues to make rap the most interesting pop genre around.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Here's more by Shazzy.
The song is strong and keeps your wide awake. Go ahead and listen. In fact, hit the dance floor. Keep it moving and soon you'll want to have more. It's like a drug, just too addictive. Only thing is it is non-prescriptive. At any age, race, rank, or color, you could move as smooth as any other. And just as sure as you pour onto the dance floor, just keep it going for all that it was done for. Rhymes are moving, words that keep going. Get on the dance floor.
This is Fresh Air. Harold McGee is a food writer who doesn't write about recipes or restaurants. His writing explains how things work in the kitchen. We're not talking about appliances, but chemistry. His new book, The Curious Cook, is filled with experiments that investigate why food does what it does when we cook it. But I wasn't sure how to categorize what McGee does.
I would describe it as kitchen science rather than food science. Food science is the professional version of what I do. It's done by people in the food industries, in food science departments and universities and so on. What I do is kitchen science, which I would distinguish as an amateur activity, something that you do for the love of it and to find out whether all the lore you get in cookbooks is true or not.
What was the first problem you tried to solve?
In the case of this book, I was interested, first of all, in whether the very commonly held idea that searing a piece of meat at a very high temperature to begin with when you're cooking it will seal in the juices and give you a more succulent result.
And does it?
It doesn't. I had gotten that impression from reading the professional literature, but I thought it would be worth trying by myself, so I just went out and got a postal scale and tried it, did the obvious thing, cooked a piece of meat with searing and a piece of meat without searing and weighed before and after and found that, if anything, searing resulted in more fluid loss than the other one did.
But so does that mean you've given up searing your meat?
No, I haven't, because the idea of searing meat is a good one. It's just that the standard explanation for it is mistaken. The reason to sear meat is that it gives you that wonderful brown crust on the outside, which doesn't do anything to seal in juices, but it does, as it were, get our juices flowing by providing a wide range of flavors that wouldn't be there otherwise. So it really makes it tastier.
I wear eyeglasses, so I particularly enjoyed an experiment you did to figure out why, when you're frying food, droplets of oil end up on the inside of your lens as opposed to the outside of your lens.
That's right. You would expect the oil to be on the outside of your glasses because it seems as though the oil coming from the pan is heading straight for your face. But I discovered by setting up pairs of eyeglasses all over my kitchen and then watching for the patterns of droplet falling as I fried, that what actually happens is that the oil drops go straight up in the air and then slowly rain down for many minutes after you're done frying. And because we're looking down at the pan, the inside of our eyeglasses is actually the surface facing upwards, and so it catches all the grease.
So what's your solution to keeping your glasses clean when you're frying?
A baseball cap. It provides just the right overhang. I did wonder whether the chef's talk would do as good a job, because it has, of course, a huge overhang. You can get them a foot tall. But it turns out not to do as good a job as a plain old baseball cap.
You know, sometimes you test things that seem so obvious. I'm like really surprised you tested. For instance, one of the tests you did for your new book was you tried to scientifically measure whether blowing on a hot cup of tea or coffee actually cools it off.
Right.
I mean you didn't trust that it did, huh?
Well, I didn't really know because you know, we do it all the time. We do it without thinking, and it's just interesting to me to find out how firmly based in reality our kind of everyday behavior is. And in fact, that turned out to be very interesting, because it turns out that blowing on a spoonful of hot soup or on a cup of coffee works fine as long as the liquid is very thin, as long as it's watery. It cuts the cooling time by about half, which I think is interesting to know. But if it's a thick soup, like pea soup or something like that, it does next to no good at all. You might as well just watch it.
Why doesn't it work with something thick like pea soup?
Because part of the cooling process involves convection, the movement of the fluid particles from cool areas to hot areas. You know, the surface will cool off very quickly because it's in contact with the cool air, whereas the interior, if it can't circulate, will stay hot. And in fact, the very phenomenon of convection itself was discovered because a marvelous scientist back in the 18th century by the name of Count Rumford noticed that he kept burning his mouth on stewed apples, but he never did that on a cup of tea. He could always tell when a cup of tea was cool. He wondered why it was that stewed apples behaved that way, and as a result, he discovered convection.
Our director, Chris Burgin, has always wondered why, when you put lemon into tea, the tea gets lighter in color.
Right. That has to do with the pigments in tea, which are very sensitive to acidity. Tea is almost like a natural version of litmus paper, which you might have used in high school to decide whether a liquid was either alkaline or acidic. And it turns out that the pigments in tea are a very good indicator of exactly how acidic the liquid is. So when you add lemon juice, those pigments get very light. And if you try the experiment of then adding a little baking soda back in, it'll get very dark again.
Let me ask you, do you ever do anything purely intuitive in the kitchen?
All the time. All the time. That's the way I do most of my cooking. This is something I do simply for the pleasure of understanding how things work.
Do you find that the science that you now know helps you cook more intuitively?
Yes, it does. Because, you know, if you don't have a sense of how things work, then I think you're much more strictly confined to recipes. You have to do things the way the recipes tell you. But if you have some sense of what these ingredients are and what the cooking process involves, then you're free to experiment, freer to experiment, because you have some sense of what it is you're doing and how a change in what you're doing might affect the outcome.
What got you started on kitchen science?
It was pure chance. I was studying literature in school, and my wife was studying biology. And my friends, my classmates, really didn't talk to biologists very often, so they asked my wife what she was doing, and she happened to be doing a project on the biochemistry of development using, as an example, the bean seed, which puts down storage proteins for the growing embryo, and that's something you can study in great detail. And they didn't quite know what all this meant, so they tried to connect it with their everyday experience, and they asked questions like, well, if you know about the biochemistry of beans, then why do they turn that awful gray color when you overcook them? Or why do you sometimes suffer a few hours after having had some dry beans? And we had no idea whether anyone knew the answers to those questions, so we went out looking one Saturday afternoon to be ready for the next encounter with my friends, and discovered this huge amount of information that had been compiled by food scientists for other food scientists, but never for the average cook. And so I decided it would be fun to translate that material for the average cook.
So now, do you know why beans can give you gas?
Yes.
Why?
Because, as I was saying, beans are basically dry beans, a storage depot of food for the embryo to use when it begins to develop, when the seed germinates. And one of the materials the bean lays down for later use is a carbohydrate similar to starch, but sufficiently different chemically that our bodies can't digest it. And because our bodies can't digest that carbohydrate, it just stays in our digestive system. It isn't absorbed. And there are a lot of bacteria in our digestive system. And when they see something lying around unused, they pounce on it and use it with a vengeance. And in the process, the bacteria produce copious quantities of carbon dioxide. So we end up feeling uncomfortable.
Have you been able to make a living from kitchen science?
Some people might wonder whether it is, but I consider it a decent living, yes.
What did you do before that?
I taught literature at a university for a couple of years.
Seems like a big jump.
Well, yes and no. I went as an undergraduate to the California Institute of Technology, which is a science and engineering school almost exclusively, although I managed to escape there with a Bachelor of Science degree in literature. I've always been interested in science, but I guess you might call it the science of everyday life, not so much the esoteric things like black holes and so on, although those are interesting, but just how things in our day-to-day life work and why we do the things we do. And so I actually see it as a natural outgrowth of what I've always been interested in.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the most unusual experiment you've ever done was?
Most unusual experiment? I think that might have to be my investigation of persimmons. These are peculiar fruits that are quite wonderful when they're ripe, but before they're ripe, they're inedible. They're so astringent. And the question I wondered was whether the cook in the kitchen could do something to persimmons to get rid of that astringency at will, rather than waiting for the fruit to ripen. And I ended up discovering that the Chinese, centuries ago, used to take these fruits and bury them in the mud for 5 days, and that would take care of it. So my job was to find a 20th century kitchen version of burying persimmons in mud to get rid of the astringency. I tried a variety of things from immersing them in water to putting them in a little plastic bag with a canister of baking soda and water to try and generate carbon dioxide. The best trick ended up being to wrap them in plastic wrap in several layers and then stick that in an oven with just the pilot light on to heat them up just a little bit, and that turns out to get rid of the astringency. The reason that this experiment caused problems is that I forgot a couple of times to indicate on the outside of the oven that there was a plastic-wrapped persimmon inside, and my wife came in to bake something and just turned the oven on to 450, and that took a few days to recover from.
Well, I wish you a happy investigating and happy eating, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Harold McGee's new book, The Curious Cook, is published by North Point Press. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on Iraq's promise to release the hostages?
Hi, Terry. Lots on that tonight, as expected. Iraq has promised to release the hostages, about 6,000 of them, Western and Japanese hostages, that's all of them. Immediately, we'll have a report from Ted Clark at the State Department and NPR's Jackie Lydon in Jordan, as well as several other aspects of that story. Also, a special feature from NPR's Michael Scholar about Biosphere 2, an installation in the desert in Arizona. It's designed for space pioneers made of glass and steel. It's supposed to be self-sufficient. And in March, 8 researchers will enter the biosphere. It'll be sealed for a 2-year period.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Edward Scissorhands is the new movie from director Tim Burton, who also developed the story for the film. Burton's other movies include Pee-wee's Big Adventure, the creepy comedy Beetlejuice, and the gothic blockbuster Batman. Critic Owen Gleiberman likes Burton's latest creation.
The hero of Tim Burton's haunting modern fairy tale, Edward Scissorhands, is a shy, ghostly boy named Edward with a beautiful powder-white face, a shock of punky black hair, and, at the end of each arm, a complicated array of 2-foot-long scissor blades, one set of shears for each finger. He's like Pinocchio with Freddy Krueger's hands. Then again, he couldn't be less threatening. Edward almost never says anything, and when he does, the voice that comes out is shockingly soft and serene, full of childlike wonder. After a while, you realize it's no coincidence that this strange and melancholy creature has such a saintly personality. If he allowed himself the tiniest bit of aggression, he might maim or even kill somebody with those thresher hands. He's probably the most justifiably oversensitive teenager in history. At the same time, Edward's energy is released in an otherworldly talent. Using his hands like a barber's shears, He can sculpt lawn hedges or ice into any shape that pleases him. Edward Scissorhands is Tim Burton's most heartfelt film yet. It's set in a color-coordinated pastel suburbia that recalls the surreal comedy of his first two movies, Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice. Only now, the synthetic bric-a-brac isn't just amusing clutter. It's become a kind of polyester dreamscape, as mythical a setting for Burton as the 50s-flavored small towns of Blue Velvet and Twin Peaks are for David Lynch. In the first part of the movie, the local Avon lady, played by Diane Wiest, pays a visit to the old gray castle where Edward lives and finds him hiding in the shadows.
Why are you hiding back there? You don't have to hide from me. Oh, my.
Don't go.
What happened to you?
I'm not finished.
Those are your hands?
Wiest brings Edward back to live with her family, and the movie turns into a fish-out-of-water comedy like Splash or E.T. Most of the neighbors are amusingly nonchalant about having Edward in their midst. He begins to decorate the suburb with his hedge sculptures, and he proves a wizardly hairdresser, too. Edward Scissorhands isn't quite the pop classic it keeps promising to be. The movie shares the narrative weaknesses of Burton's other films, and now that he's trying to create a fully emotional story, the thinness of the script hurts more than before. When Edward falls in love with Wiest's cheerleader daughter, played by Winona Ryder, and comes into conflict with her thuggish boyfriend, the fairy tale structure clearly points toward Edward confronting the latent violence in his hands. Yet the film doesn't turn dark enough. Burton may have been wary of making it too disturbing for kids. Still, whatever its flaws, I loved Edward Scissorhands simply for the character of Edward. He's Burton's purest achievement as a director so far, and teen idol Johnny Depp plays him with a surprisingly delicate touch. There's an obvious personal dimension to the character. For Edward is Burton's surreal portrait of himself as an artist, a wounded child converting his private darkness into outlandish pop visions. With Edward Scissorhands, Burton's artistry takes a new leap.
Owen Glaberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a look at the Gulf crisis from the perspective of oil. We talk with Daniel Yergin, the author of A New History of Oil Politics. And we examine human rights violations in Iraq, as well as in the countries we're aligned with in the Gulf, with Andrew Whitley, Executive Director of Middle East Watch. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.